San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening, everybody. It's actually just Richard. Joe taking a little break this Saturday evening, so it's Richard Muzio all by himself, without the inimitable Joe Vecchio on. It's Your Money and Your Life. And as part of a continuing series regarding the Servant Leadership Institute's upcoming 5th Annual National Conference, which is on March 9th and 10th in lovely Coronado, California, at the Coronado Marriott, we've got a very special guest on the line who's going to be on the keynote panel at that event, and that would be the internationally best-selling author, Dr. Ken Blanchard. Dr. Blanchard, how are you this evening?
Well, good. I'm doing just great.
I really appreciate you being on the show, and I know we're a couple weeks away here from this big, big event down at the Coronado Marriott for Servant Leadership Institute, and our good friend Art Barter, who was a recent guest here on this show. Just curious, how did you become familiar with Art Barter and the work that he's doing at Servant Leadership Institute?
Well, I got to know Art through a thing that we had started called Vision San Diego, that we were trying to see what we could do to make San Diego really America's finest city, as a lot of people know. And Art got involved early on, and then I found out about his whole interest in servant leadership and the Institute. So I just think the world is in desperate need of a different leadership role model. We've seen what self-serving leaders have done in every sector of society and not very helpful. So Art and I are soulmates, I think.
That's a good way to put it. So I know you gained international acclaim with one of the all-time best-selling books in history called The 1 Minute Manager. And that was quite some time ago. Can you give us some brief background on how that book came to be and how that concept came to you? It's one of the best leadership and management books I've ever read.
Well, you know, life is what happens to you, as you know, when you're planning on doing something else. Mm-hmm. I was a college professor, you know, and I taught for 10 years and taught leadership and organizational behavior, had a textbook and all. And came out here on a sabbatical leave for 1 year to San Diego from University of Massachusetts. And after a couple of months, my wife said, "Why are we going back to Massachusetts? You know, summer in Massachusetts is 6 weeks of bad skating, although, you know, they got 6 or 7 inches of feet of snow up there right now."
Yeah, it's amazing.
But we early on, while we were here, we decided to stay. We were invited to a cocktail party that Adelaide Bree, who was an author in town, had for authors in San Diego, and somehow we qualified because of my textbook. And so Spencer Johnson was there, and I don't know if you know it, Spencer was a children's book writer. He wrote a whole series of kids' books years ago called Value Tales.
Right.
And the value of curiosity, the story of Christopher Columbus, the value of honesty, the story of Abe Lincoln. So my wife met Spencer first at this party, and she hand-carried him over to me, and she said, "You guys ought to write a children's book for managers. They won't read anything else." And that was our introduction, and Spencer was working on a kind of a one-minute parenting, one-minute scolding with a psychiatrist, and I invited him to a seminar, and he sat in the back and laughed and came running up at the end and said, "Forget parenting, let's do the one-minute manager." And we met the first week in November, and we had a first draft of that book going to the Rose Bowl at the end of December.
I mean, oh, wow.
That book wrote us, and then we self-published it because we knew we weren't known in New York, and they would beat us up and take all the money. So we self-published it, sold 25,000 copies with no advertising, except from, you know, my clients and stuff like that. And so then when we went to New York, they seem to be much more interested. And so we're actually coming out with a new one-minute manager in May. We've never redone the book or even had an e-book in 30-plus years. And we discovered, of course, that the one-minute manager, the concepts are still great and the story's great, but the whole style was much more command and control. And today it's much more side-by-side leadership, and we actually even changed the one-minute reprimand, the third secret, to one-minute redirect. So it's a whole different tone of the new one-minute manager.
I was wondering, you know, given that 1 minute now is an eternity, whereas 30 years ago, 1 minute wasn't. Everything moves faster in sound bites. Is it still 1 minute?
Should be 30 seconds, but it's still 1 minute.
Okay, gotcha. That's funny. But I know that book, I think it came out in 1982. It's literally been on the best-selling list now for going on over 30 years, which is
it's incredible. Pretty amazing, yeah.
Just so you say the new version coming out, you said, in May?
In May, yes.
Okay. We'll have you back on when the book is scheduled to release so we can promote it some more for you.
It's actually going to be called The New One-Minute Manager, yeah.
Okay. Neat stuff. So you're going to be presenting out here, I know, as well as on a panel with, Stephen M. Arcovey and John Maxwell on March the 9th. Is this the first time the three of you have been on a panel together?
No, we've been on panels at different times, not all three of us.
Okay.
I've been on panels with John Maxwell in places, and as well as, you know, Stephen M. R., but the three of us have never been together, which is really exciting because I have the highest respect for both of them. I was a good buddy with Stephen M. R.'s dad, and boy, he is just as good as his dad, and is doing really great stuff. So and Maxwell's always pushing the envelope. So it's going to be fun.
Yeah, first time ever. We've been telling everybody, first time ever the three of you are appearing simultaneously and all together.
Yes.
And it's going to be fun. Whoever the moderator is, I assume that's Art himself.
Yes.
But that's going to be a fun job. It won't even be a job. That'll just be pure fun for him. So I notice you now call yourself the Chief Spiritual Officer for the Ken Blanchard Company. What does the Chief Spiritual Officer do on a daily basis? I'm just curious.
Well, I tell you, a number of years ago, I had lunch with Max Dupree, who was the legendary chairman of Herman Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Max, what's your job as chairman of this great company? And he said, Ken, I have to be like a third grade teacher. I have to say the vision and values over and over and over again till people get it right. And so I never liked the concept of being chairman. You know, my wife was president, and then her brother became president of our company. We got over 300 people in an office in Toronto and London and in Singapore. But my wife heads up the Office of the Future, and they were studying what created spirit in a workplace. And I thought, wow, that's what I need to be, is the Chief Spiritual Officer. So it's not, you know, necessarily about faith, but it's about how do we keep our purpose and our vision, our values out front of us constantly so we're committed to what we're doing and making a difference, because that all the research on employee engagement says that that's one of the most important factors, that people have something bigger than themselves to serve. So that's what I remind them of. I leave a morning message every single day for everybody in our company. So it's a kind of a fun thing.
Yeah, in fact, when we called you the first time to get you online here, we got your answering machine. I love the message. So glad we tracked you down, too, or we would have had some dead air. But so anyway, question about how leadership has changed. I started in the business world in 1980 when I was all of 21 years old. And as you mentioned earlier, it was very much a command and control environment. I now find myself working in all kinds of different collaborative relationships where sometimes you're the leader, sometimes you're the follower. How have things changed since you wrote The One-Minute Manager more than 30 years ago in terms of the major changes that leaders should be sensitive to?
Well, I think the big changes is that the people, particularly younger people, they couldn't believe that we used to call managers superiors, and their people working for them subordinate, you know, subordinary people. And
right.
We talked about the head of the department and the hired hands. We didn't even give them a head, you know, and people would say, what's your job? I'm in supervision, you know. I mean, and, you know, the belief now is that everybody really can contribute and make a difference because of the whole information explosion with technology. No longer is all the information in the top management's office. In fact, everybody has access to information, and therefore what we really need to realize is that none of us, is one of my favorite sayings, is as smart as all of us, and that what we really need to do is find ways to empower people, involve them, seek their counsel and all, and then they are really committed to make a difference out there.
Yeah, and in terms of changing demographics, when I came up in the business world, there were very few women other than in positions of secretary and so on. Now we have a workforce that is maybe more than 50%. And then, of course, in terms of generations, the youngest generation, millennials and so on, they think differently than guys like me who were born in the 1950s think. And I just think changing demographics are so huge in terms of what leaders have to be sensitive to actually bring about positive change and you know, put forth a very positive culture with their companies, because I think the young people really want to do something that makes a difference in the world, not just make money, for example.
Yes, and that's why I think that Art's and my belief in John Maxwell and Stephen M. R., we all believe that servant leadership is the only way to get both great results and great human satisfaction. And it's interesting, you know, when I talk to people in business initially about servant leadership, they think I'm talking about the inmates running the prison or trying to please everybody.
Yeah, Dr. Berlancher, can you hold that thought? Because we've got to take a quick commercial break.
Sure.
But we're going to come back right there. We'll be right back with It's Your Money and Your Life. Everybody, sit tight.
AM 760 KFMB.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Your Money and Your Life. This is Richard Musio without my co-host Joe Vecchio for the evening. And we've got Dr. Ken Blanchard on the line. Again, we're talking about the upcoming Servant Leadership Institute National Conference at the Coronado Marriott on March 9th and 10th, servantleadershipinstitute.com. Dr. Blanchard, thanks for hanging in there with us. When we went to break, we were talking about some people saying, well, servant leadership is really about the inmates running the asylum. And how could that possibly ever work?
Yeah, or trying to please everybody or some kind of religious movement. But what they don't understand is that there's two parts of servant leadership. One is vision and direction. In other words, people have to have something to serve, and so you need to know what business you're in, what's your picture of the future, where you're trying to accomplish, what are your values to guide your journey, and what are your goals. And that's the leadership part of servant leadership. And it's the responsibility of the traditional hierarchy to make sure that that is clear. And if that isn't clear, you know, like I wrote a paper, I tried to get to Obama and Romney and all these people about why Washington's such a mess, because we don't have any vision or values that we agree upon in this country anymore. And if there's nothing to serve, the only thing you get to serve is yourself. And so you've got to start with the leadership part of servant leadership. And once people are clear on where you're heading and what you're trying to accomplish and what are the values that guide your journey, now philosophically you turn that pyramid upside down, and now you get to the servant part of servant leadership, where now what you're trying to do is help everybody live according to the vision and accomplish the goals. You work for them. And boy, that's really talking about implementing side-by-side leadership, because it's not about everybody sucking up the hierarchy and thinking all the brains are up there. The belief is that we can really solve problems here, and your job is to cheerlead us on and help guide us in the direction that we need to go. But it's a whole different game. So it's the leadership part, which is vision and direction and goals, and then the servant part, which is how do you get that? But you got to philosophically turn that pyramid upside down when you do that. And when Jesus washed the feet of the disciples, he was transitioning from vision and direction to implementation. He had kind of a slow group, so it took him quite a long time to realize why he was here. But when he knew he was going to leave physically, he had to transition them to take over. So that's what that was there.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. One of the other things that I find fascinating about servant leadership is it expands, I would say, the definition of who the constituents of a business or an enterprise are. Typically, we would think of them as being shareholders or trying to maximize economic return to shareholders, and then maybe the team members, employees, the staff, what, you know, whatever term you wish to use. But now it also encompasses bringing in other constituents like vendors, the community itself, the environment, governmental agencies, and so on.
Yes.
And I just think that's really neat because it's very clear that business doesn't just affect the company's owners or customers.
And what we find with all the great companies that get this, you know, whether you're talking about Southwest Airlines, whether you're talking about Chick-fil-A, whether you're talking about Wegmans in the grocery business, Nordstrom in retail, Synovus in financial services, Disney in entertainment, is they think their number one customer is their people. And if they empower their people, encourage their people, train their people, they'll go out of the way to take care of their number two most important customer, the people they serve, which is not only the people that use their products and services, you say, but you're also talking about the suppliers, the citizens, you know, all the different groups. And then if they do a really good job there, those people are going to brag on you, and that's going to take care of the third most important customer, which is the owners and the people who have the financial thing. But what happens is very often Wall Street and the pressures of all act like the most important thing is to make money, and then your customers might be important, but your people are dispendable, and that just doesn't work in the long run.
No, I agree. And yeah, you obviously see short-term focus on Wall Street, you know, things like quarterly results. Your point about why government doesn't work, I think one reason why government in this country no longer works is because everybody's trying to get elected next term and nobody's thinking two or three generations down the road.
That's right.
About what kind of world we're leaving for our children, our grandchildren. It's, I just need to get elected again in 2 years.
That's right.
And, you know, it just doesn't bode well for what I guess you would call legacy. And that's unfortunate. So can you give us some advance notice about what you might be talking about at Servant Leadership Institute, or what you expect the panel to be like?
Well, I think Art is always pushing us, you know, about, you know, Warren Bennis, whenever I saw him, and he passed away recently, mm-hmm. always say, Ken, what has come clear to you since we last talked? And, you know, one of the things that's come clear to me, I'm thinking about working on a book entitled, Duh, Why Isn't Common Sense Common Practice? You know, because, yeah. as I say, when I look at the companies that are leading in their fields, they all get what Art Barter and the Servant Leadership Institute and Maxwell and Covey and all of us are talking about. And why don't the rest of them get that, you know? And so that's really one of the things I really want to talk to John and Steve and MR about is, you know, what's your experience? Why aren't more people getting it? I mean, I think we're making some progress, but it you'd say, why would you think more people would get it, you know?
Yeah, I love that title because I've had a couple of customer services experiences where I just leave shaking my head.
Yes.
Say, you know, somebody says, well, we can't do that because that's company policy. And I reply, well, isn't company policy to take good care of your customer?
Yes. You know, and
they're like, well, no, that's not what the rules say.
I always get, people get a big kick because I always end up somehow talking about, you can tell a company run by self-serving leaders because as a front line of people, you're dealing with ducks, not eagles, and they're going quack, quack, it's our policy, quack, quack.
Right.
I just work here, you know. And where if you're dealing with a great company, you're dealing with an eagle who soars above the crowd and says, I'll take care of it. I'll get back to you. Good point. Let me see what I can do about that.
Yeah, it's such a big difference. Mark Twain once said that the most dangerous thing is what we know that we know that just ain't so. And so many companies, I think they know what they know, but they just aren't in tune with their customers or their constituents.
Yeah,
so they think they know something, but it isn't true.
No, that's the duh.
Right, you know, that's the duh part. So, hey, personal question. I know you're an avid golfer. Is it true that you belong to a golf club in Scotland?
Yes, we actually dropped out recently, but we belong to Loch Lomond.
Okay.
Where they always played the Scottish Open.
Sure,
before. And we got into that when they were just opening it. And what a fabulous course. And I played all over Scotland and Ireland. And it's just fun to go back where the game started, you know, and just to do it. And, you know, the weather's always unpredictable. I remember my wife and I coming up the 18th in Turnberry. And mm-hmm. we had played completely in a downpour the whole 18. And she looked at me and said, "Why are we doing this?" And I says, "It's Scotland."
Well, I guess if you can play that course, you better go play that course.
Yes, it's wonderful. We enjoy it, solely enjoy it. And the Scottish people are wonderful.
Absolutely.
Just fun to be around.
So what else do you have on your agenda? I know you've got the new book coming out in May. What are your plans for after that, if I may ask?
Well, I have a book that just came out, just Catching a Real Chord, that I might talk a little bit about.
Okay, sure.
They're called Refire, Don't Retire, Make the Rest of Your Life the Best of Your Life, that I did with Mort Shavitz, who's mm-hmm. a psychology professor here at UC San Diego. And it's hit a real chord with people because when I was 65, a number of years ago, I was on the phone with old Zig Ziglar, the motivation
sure.
guy, and he had invited my wife and I to the 59th anniversary of his 21st birthday. I said, "Ziggy, you got to retire." He said, "There's no mention of him in the Bible except for Jesus, Mary, and David."
Yeah.
Nobody under 80 made an impact. I'm refiring, not retiring. And so I just got excited about that concept and what does refiring mean? And so what Mort and I are asking people to do is look at what are you doing to refire intellectually to keep your mind active?
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing emotionally, relationships? Are you in a rut? You're doing the same thing with the same people in the same way, having lunch with the same group of people at work and all that. What are you doing physically to keep yourself in shape so you can go? And then finally, spiritually, what are you doing there? Not in terms of a religion, but you know, what's your purpose in life? What are you trying to accomplish? And how do you get your ego out of the way? Realize you're here to serve rather than be served. And so that's been an exciting venture.
Yeah, and a neat thing I've noticed, a lot of people say around age 65, that you know their careers are over, but they still want to work, or in some cases have to, but they want to, I think in some cases, in many cases, do something different and maybe a little bit more meaningful than what they'd been used to for the last 20, 30, 40 years. Because there's obviously a great need in the workplace for talented people, and of course the wisdom that people of the baby boomer generation offer is just incredible.
Yes, and well, we're working on some ways that companies could take advantage of the wisdom of older people who could be mentors for younger people, but also help them, train and get people younger to be ready, but mm-hmm. don't just set them off in the sunset. But how can you use that wisdom and that power and not lose it, maybe not in a full-time way, but in a way that makes a difference? And then people, Mort's research on aging says that the most happy people are the people who retire to something, not from something.
Right, exactly. Hey, Dr. Blanchard, we really, really appreciate your time. We've got to take our bottom of the hour break. But we look forward to seeing you out at the Servant Leadership Institute conference on March 9th and 10th. And again, very, very much appreciate your time and your insights.
Well, thank you. And I think the conference is going to be fabulous and people ought to come. And I'm a big fan of Art Barter and the whole Datron and what they're trying to do in this area. Maxwell and Stephen M. R. are fabulous. So the worst it can be is unbelievable.
Very much appreciate it. Thanks again.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Richard Musio, and we're back, and it's time to thank our sponsors. We couldn't do this great show without our wonderful sponsors, and in no particular order, that would be UBS, Mr. Michael Carantra and Drew Freitas from UBS on Prospect Street in La Jolla. Thank you very much. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Polito Epic, CPAs in Vista, that's Don Epic, CPA, and Paul Polito, CPA. Our other most favorite CPA on the planet, Jason Kruger, CPA with Signature Analytics, the best CFO firm here in San Diego. Brenda Geiger with the Law Office of Brenda Geiger. Brenda specializes in asset protection and estate planning. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group, helping business owners with business valuation and understanding the risks that drive the values of their businesses and how to reduce those risks and increase business value. Our new banking sponsor, California Republic Bank with Lane Elliott, specializing in working with wealthy families and family offices. Hub International Insurance, formerly Mars Maddox Insurance. Neil Staley, going to be an upcoming guest here in March experts in the Health Care Act and employee benefits. Stop Financial Elder Abuse Alliance with Paul Hines from Hearthstone Wealth Management. And certainly last but not least, Servant Leadership Institute. Check out servantleadershipinstitute.com. And of course, they are the subject of tonight's show. So a big thank you to all of our sponsors. And if any listeners want more information about our sponsors, how to find them, what they do, everything is up on our website at iymoney.com. So artfully maintained by Courtney Lover with PopX Graphics. So again, check out iymoney.com for more information about our great sponsors. We have with us a very special guest. That would be Debbie Marriott Harrison. And Debbie's going to be coming out here to San Diego, actually the beautiful island of Coronado at the Coronado Marriott on March 9th and 10th for Servant Leadership Institute's 5th annual national conference. And Debbie's going to be leading one of the panel presentations, but she's actually Marriott's Global Officer for Culture and Business Councils. Did I get your title right, Debbie?
That's correct. Thank you.
And welcome to the show. We really appreciate you carving some time out of your busy day to talk about what you do. So I know you're back east, and I guess you're probably looking forward to having some nice weather when you come out here in just over a month.
Yes, I can't wait to be in San Diego. We just had a smaller snowstorm than is happening now up the coast from us. I'm in the D.C. area,
okay.
And it'll be great to be out in Southern California.
You can't beat the weather out here, and I won't tell you what the weather's like, but you'll get to, well, you've been out here before for Servant Leadership
Institute. Oh, we lived out there for 8 years in the area, and I have 4 out of my 5 kids that live in the L.A. area.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah,
we've been very
familiar.
We've gotten some rain finally, which we needed, but otherwise
yeah,
it's been great.
That's true. Yep.
It's been great. So can we talk about this concept of culture? A lot of people, when they think about corporations, don't really think that there's any culture that goes along with that. That organizations are just these dry sort of things that make money for their shareholders. Why is culture so important to a successful business?
Well, we believe that our culture gives us our competitive advantage in the hotel industry, and that's because it started as a mom-and-pop it started as a mom-and-pop store where my grandparents started in 1927. They drove across the United States from Salt Lake City in their Model T Ford. It took them 11 days to get to Washington,
wow.
D.C., and when they arrived here, they opened up a 9-stool root beer stand downtown Washington, and this was in May. And in the fall, when the weather got cold, they knew they'd go out of business if they didn't put hot food items on the menu. So they added chili, tamales, hot dogs, hamburgers, and they started a restaurant chain called the Hot Shops. And that was in 1927. We didn't open our first hotel until 1957.
Okay.
So really, our culture is such an integral part of what we do. It's very values-based, and it's based on the values that my grandparents and my father had. My grandparents were the entrepreneurs, and my father built the business and really turned it into the number one hotel chain in the world over the years by building it up and adding more and more hotels. So we feel that the stories we have to tell, the values that we inculcate, are what gives us our competitive advantage. We believe in putting people first, and we've always from the time my grandfather started the Hot Shops, he had a sign in his kitchens that said, if you take care of the employee will take care of the customer,
mm-hmm.
and the customer will come back again and again. So I love telling our founding story because it helps keep us on the right track. And culture can be very hard to define, as you probably know. And the best definition I've heard is it's how we do things around here. So a few years ago, we sat down and we put our heads together and we came up with 5 core values that we feel are the foundation of our culture. They are put people first, embrace change, act with integrity, pursue excellence, and serve our world, which will fit in nicely with the Servant Leadership event that's coming up in San Diego.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the part about change because I was talking to somebody the other day about how the universe only really rewards action and change. It doesn't really reward staying still or remaining static. Yet
that's
so many
true.
People are afraid of change. I know you're leading a workshop called Cultivating a Culture of Success, so I'm assuming some of these stories you're telling now will be part of the workshop that you're doing out at Servant Leadership Institute. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm going to tell the story of how our company was founded with lots of pictures and videos, and we really have a culture of storytelling embedded, and in fact, one of the things that we like to talk about around here is that the new leader today doesn't only manage his people and his or her team, but the new leader today also talks about a lot of stories and change and is more innovative, and a lot of that is embedded in storytelling. In fact, one of the rock stars around here we have now that was hired recently is in charge of our content marketing, and so we're even changing the way we market things by and market ourselves by telling stories about what we're doing and telling stories about travel. And a lot of this is driven by the focus we have on the next generation traveler and associate. So right now we have over 50% of our customers as the Gen Y group or the millennials, and we have to get their loyalty now. And they don't like to be talked at, so they like stories and they like adventure. So this is a whole new way of looking at things.
Speaking of great stories to tell, I've got a really, really amazing one, but we've got to take a quick break. So Debbie, sit tight. All of our listeners, please do the same. We'll be right back with It's Your Money and Your Life with Debbie Marriott Harrison.
AM 760 KFMB.
This is Richard Musio, and we are back with It's Your Money and Your Life. Well, let me tell you a story about Marriott. You have a lot of different brands.
Yes, we do. We have 18, and this morning we just announced that we were buying a new one from Canada called Delta Hotel.
So oh, congratulations.
Yep.
But if memory serves, Spring Hill Suites is one of your brands, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And so here's a story about amazing service at your Spring Hill Suites in Oceanside, California. I ran the Carlsbad Half Marathon recently.
Well, congratulations.
And because we had relatives in town, my wife decided it might be a good idea for me to go get a room somewhere near the start line instead of trying to stay up until midnight. Thanks, by the way, you know, with relatives and so on, because I wouldn't run very well. And so I booked a room for a couple of nights at the Spring Hill Suites in Oceanside, California, which is just down the street from Carlsbad, where I was running the half marathon. And when I walked in to check in, the woman behind the desk actually knew who I was and thanked me for the work that I had done in Oceanside. My foundation had hosted a Thanksgiving morning event in Oceanside where we had over 16,000 people and raised over $100,000 for local charities. And most people don't even know I'm the founder of that event.
Wow.
But somehow she did and thanked me and also mentioned that, of course, the Spring Hill Marriott Suites were sold out that weekend because of our event, and just thanked me for what I was doing in the community, which is a total shock to me because, you know, I tend to fly beneath the radar with most of my charitable stuff. So to get that from somebody who I just met for the first time behind the, you know, the check-in desk at one of, I mean, that was just an amazing customer service experience for me to just feel so wanted by, you know, the people who were working there when I walked in. I didn't even know they knew I existed. But then, to make it even better, because more relatives came into town, my wife suggested I should book one extra night, right? Because there was no room for me to even come home at that point. And the one extra night required that I would have to turn my keys in after two nights to get, you know, rekeyed for the third night. And that would be the morning of, or, you know, by the afternoon after the morning that I ran the half marathon. And so the same woman behind the desk who reminded me, you know, 2 days earlier to turn my keys in, I actually did that right when I got back from the half marathon, and she wasn't there yet. Somebody else was working the front desk. But then that afternoon, after my wife and I went to lunch, when I was walking by the front desk, she said, "Oh, Richard, I just wanted to make sure, have you turned your keys in to get your new key for your room yet?"
Wow.
I mean, she remembered.
That's terrific. Well, that's the kind of customer service that we love to hear about, and that's the kind that we try and promote. And that goes along with putting people first. And that doesn't just mean our associates. It means our customers and guests and in our all of our stakeholders, even our owners and our franchise owners. So we try and put put everyone first and make them feel special. We actually really promote the fact that we are run by a we have been run by a family in 85 years. We only had two CEOs, my grandfather and my father. Now we have the first non-family member, Arne Sorensen, who we love and support 100%. But we have a lot of family members working in the company, and we want everyone to feel that we're part of a big family, which is tough to do when you have over 175,000 associates with our managed hotels and another 150,000 with our franchise hotels around the world. So.
Sure. But, yeah, the folks at the Spring Hill Suites and Marriott in Oceanside certainly made me feel like I was family, so I really appreciate that.
Well, that's great. It's great advertisement, too.
Exactly. I noticed back, I guess it was around this past summer, 2014, you actually replaced your brother on the board of directors of Marriott International Inc. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
How many people on your board?
11.
And are they all familiar with the Servant Leadership Institute concept, or is this something sort of new that you're trying to embed into the corporate culture?
No, they're all familiar with our culture and how we serve others and serve our communities and how we our culture is really important to us.
And when you're working with a board of 11, how do you handle change? Because I know change is difficult not only for the rank and file employees, but just with regard to leadership teams. What are the processes or the things that you do to try to make people comfortable with change?
Well, we frame it up as we need to change or we're not going to be successful because the customer demographic is changing, and the baby boomers who have been in charge for the last few years are retiring and getting older, and I think everybody on the board and in the company understands that this is the way of the future and that we have to adjust and that we have to be more innovative. And in fact, we even have a new innovation team at corporate headquarters that's been around for the last 3 or 4 years, and they have done tremendous work here at getting us all to try and change our mindsets and do some creative and innovative thinking, and then that cascades out into the field. So it's been really fun to be around all of this new energy.
And do you know about how many people you're expecting in your workshop yet? I'm just curious.
I think they told me about 150.
Yeah, because I heard about maybe 600 people were going to attend, so that would make sense since you're one of the breakout sessions.
Yeah.
When you do these workshops, what are the biggest challenges that people present or bring up when they ask questions? Just curious.
I haven't done that many workshops outside of the company. I've done speeches and presentations.
Okay.
And they'll ask me questions about, the future of the company. Are we going to buy more brands? Why do we have so many brands? Those are the typical questions they ask. How are you going to promote your culture with the tremendous growth you have around the world? That's a huge challenge to our culture. It's also a challenge that we, in the United States, have almost 80% of our hotels as franchise hotels. And so we have to make sure that we try and model the culture that we have for them so that they treat their associates as well as we treat ours.
Makes sense. Now, I noticed your company has, I think it said, 76 worldwide business councils. What do you mean by business councils? What are they and how do they work?
Well, that's a great question. Business councils are where, in our larger markets, all of our general managers and others get together and they talk about their markets. So they talk about business. They pool together their resources so that they can save money in their markets. They preserve our culture through employee recognition events and customer events. They do a lot of government affairs work, especially in the United States, where they can all get together and go to their capitals and their chambers of commerce and lobby for things that will help promote our business. And they also do a lot of community service, which really enhances our reputation in our communities. And so they do a lot of good. We're the only hotel company that has a system of business councils, which really helps us communicate down from corporate headquarters and then from the field back up to to corporate headquarters, and they are such a valuable tool that we have, and I think it's one of the secrets to our being such a successful company.
So you're saying that, so you know, in other words, that's just a key part of your corporate strategy. That's what you're saying, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah, that and do you have
and,
to
and
meet?
It's interesting because they were started way in the 80s when we had several businesses. We had in-flight catering. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, the theme parks. There's one up in Santa Clara called Great America that's now a Six Flags, but we started that.
Okay.
We had all sorts of different businesses, food distribution, and so they started them to coordinate all these businesses so that the communication was good. And now that we're all hotels only, the general managers come together and they form these councils, which is just a terrific tool for us.
Do you have to meet with all of them individually during the course of a year? I'm just curious.
No, I mean, they are all over the world. When I do travel, though, to give presentations, I always try and meet with them. So I've been in this job a little over a year, and I've met with maybe 12 or 15 of them during the year. So it's really been a fun thing to work with the general managers out in the field. They are terrific people.
That's it. Hey, Debbie, we really appreciate your time.
We're very
much looking forward to having you out here at the Servant Leadership Institute event again on March 9th and 10th at the lovely Coronado Marriott on Coronado Island.
Again, it is a lovely hotel.
It's absolutely gorgeous. I like to have lunch meetings there so we can just relax and stare at the water.
It's great.
It's gorgeous. Okay. Again, servantleadershipinstitute.com. But really appreciate you having you know, spending some time and talking about, without giving away too many secrets, because we want people to pay to come to that event. So
great. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to me.
All right. Thanks again. Have a great rest of the week.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. As always, a big thank you to Eric Rubalcaba on the board, helping us out as he does so professionally every Saturday night. Also, big thanks to Dave Sniff, our programming genius, and Craig Blanke on the sales side. My partner Joe Vecchio will be back when the Servant Leadership Institute series is done. He's been out working on a special film project. So again, thanks everybody. Join us next week on It's Your Money and Your Life. Have a great week, everybody. Thank you.
AM 760.